time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, March 12th, 2025. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. In tonight's news, the Madison clerk has been put on administrative leave amid several ongoing investigations into uncounted ballots last November.
We continue our interviews with candidates for city council. Tonight's Alder-to-Be says Madison needs a stronger lobby in the state legislature.
And in the second half, we'll learn how UW-Madison leaders are preparing for federal cost-cutting measures, revisit some headlines from 58 years ago, and hear all about this upcoming storm on Friday.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Donald Trump has confirmed that US officials are travelling to Russia to discuss a proposed 30-day ceasefire with Ukraine. Kyiv accepted the proposals during a meeting in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, led by the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman has been speaking to Mr. Rubio.
He said this was about how they wanted the world to look within days in terms of using diplomacy. But it also gave us a sense, I think, of the urgency with which the Trump administration wants to do all of this. Now, I think that will enhance some of the sense of criticism there've been around this, that the idea of trying to rush a truce will embolden the invading power. But the Americans say this is about using diplomacy rather than fighting.
Meanwhile, the Kremlin says President Putin has visited a command post in the Kursk region, where Russia has been retaking territory that was seized by Ukrainian forces last year. If confirmed, it would be the first time Mr. Putin has visited Kursk since Ukrainian troops stormed into the region last August. Ministers from Europe's five main military powers have ended a meeting in Paris focusing on defence priorities in the face of uncertainty about US policy. Gatherings of the recently formed E5 group of nations, France, Britain, Germany, Italy and Poland, are expected to become a regular occurrence. Speaking at a news conference, the British Defence Secretary John Healey said they'd agreed to focus their efforts on greater cooperation to boost security across the region.
Between our five nations, we recognise that we must take on more responsibility for European security. So today in Paris, we have agreed we must rearm, we must spend more, we must work together to strengthen our industrial base. Our industry must be capable of innovating at wartime pace and must make defence an engine for economic growth in each of our nations.
The Pakistani military says an operation to rescue hundreds of train passengers taken hostage by separatist rebels in the southwest has ended. A spokesman said more than 300 hostages had been freed from the train, which was seized by militants in Balochistan province on Tuesday. He said 33 rebels were killed during the assault, 21 civilian hostages and 4 soldiers were killed by the Baloch Liberation Army before the operation began. Here's Embarrassan Etarajan.
This was an unprecedented move by the Baloch rebels. So there will be questions asked how this was allowed to happen. But this also shows how the Baloch rebels are increasingly targeting in a higher value targets in the past few months. Now, this attack will give more publicity for the rebels. If the military goes against the rebels, if they launch any strong high-ended military operation, that could further alienate the Baloch ethnic community. And that is the danger.
BBC News. The former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is in custody at the International Criminal Court in The Hague after arriving in the Netherlands from Manila. He was detained on an ICC arrest warrant on charges of murder as a crime against humanity in connection with his war on drugs. More than 6,000 drug dealers, users and others were killed in a brutal anti-drugs campaign during Mr. Duterte's tenure between 2016 and 2022. Karim Khan is the prosecutor at the ICC.
The judges have found reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Duterte has committed the crime of murder as the founder, as the head of the so-called Davao death squad, as the mayor of Davao City, and then later as the president of the Philippines.
Some of America's biggest trading partners have unveiled countermeasures after President Trump's blanket tariffs on steel and aluminium imports to the United States took effect. Canada announced additional duties on more than $20 billion worth of US goods from Thursday, while the European Union said it was imposing retaliatory tariffs on goods worth $28 billion from next month. The Trump administration has announced the scrapping of a swathe of environmental protections introduced under President Biden, including restrictions on carbon emissions from coal plants, cars, and lorries. The rules are due to take effect from 2032 and would have forced factories to reduce their carbon dioxide output by 90% or shut down. At least 30 people have been detained after a march by Argentine pensioners against government cuts turned violent. The weekly demonstration had been joined by supporters of four Buenos Aires football clubs in memory of the Argentine football star Diego Maradona. He once said, "You'd have to be a real coward not to defend retirees," a cry that's become a rallying call as the value of the state pension shrinks under President Javier Milei.
Good evening. This is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
We are now less than 3 weeks away from the April 1st nonpartisan election, and today is the last day to register by mail or online. You can check your registration status at myvote.wi.org. Meanwhile, today, a Waukesha appeals court has said that voters with disabilities cannot get their absentee ballot by email, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Today's decision upends a decision last summer from a Dane County judge who okayed it. The case was originally brought by voting rights advocates and disabled voters last spring. They argued that barring email as an option amounted to a violation of federal voting protections. Other groups of people are still in the clear to get emailed ballots, including voters who are overseas and those on active duty. And Wisconsin has allowed email voting before. Former Governor Scott Walker eliminated that practice for disabled voters in 2011.
The two candidates running for the vacant Wisconsin Supreme Court seat will face off tonight in their only scheduled debate, according to the Associated Press. Conservative Brad Schimmel and liberal Susan Crawford are scheduled to debate tonight at 7 p.m. on WISN and online at wisi.org. The debate is likely to focus on both their records as judges, with each accusing the other of being soft on crime. Schimmel is a former state attorney general and district attorney. Crawford is a current Dane County judge. The race will decide the ideological majority of Wisconsin's top court, which is poised to be the deciding voice on issues where the Republican-controlled legislature and the Democratic executive branch can't agree.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers slammed the Trump administration yesterday for cutting food assistance programs, urging the Trump administration to reverse course. That comes after the USDA announced on Monday that the local food purchase assistance program would be cut. The program helps farmers get their products to local food banks across Wisconsin, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. Nearly 300 Wisconsin farms have participated in the program, which distributes about $4 million worth of food across the state. Also cut was a food program that connected schools with local farms. In a press release, Governor Evers claimed the cancellations renege on contractual obligations and violate Congress's power of the purse. The cuts come at a time when Wisconsin farmers are poised to already face rising costs as a result of new trade tariffs.
And the Wisconsin Assembly Committee held its first public meeting yesterday, according to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's called GOAT, and it is modeled after the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, undertaken by the Trump administration at the federal level. GOAT, which stands for Government Operations, Accountability, and Transparency, was formed last December. Like DOGE, it claims to address government inefficiency. The committee spent its first meeting discussing the use of remote work for government employees in Wisconsin. Remote work has come under scrutiny in the state with a bill introduced that would require state employees to work in person starting this summer. In the meeting, representatives from state agencies defended their continuing use of remote work, citing recruitment considerations and savings from reduced office space. Unlike the federal DOGE, GOAT lacks the power of the executive, and any actions recommended by the committee would need to be passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor.
The Milwaukee Public School Board voted today to take action on serious problems outlined in an audit released last month, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The audit identified ineffective leadership, declining enrollment, and teacher shortages as critical issues to resolve. Today, the Public School Board's Committee on Parent and Community Engagement passed a resolution to create an operational review committee to develop a plan based on the audit's recommendations and deliver progress reports quarterly. The audit laid out three goals to pursue: create a coherent central system, foster meaningful communication and collaboration, and operating and funding strategically. The committee's resolution will go to the full public school board for approval next week.
If you found your eyelids drooping after this past weekend with the now darker mornings, this might perk you up. A new proposal in the Wisconsin legislature would eliminate daylight savings time in the state, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. The proposal would put the state on standard time year-round, eliminating the spring forward that occurred this past weekend. The move would put the state in line with others that do not observe daylight savings, like Arizona and Hawaii. A similar measure was proposed in 2017 before ultimately being scrapped. That proposal faced significant pushback from people who enjoyed more light in the evenings, while standard time does prioritize sunlight in the mornings.
The City Council rejected a proposal for a new subdivision on Madison's north side yesterday. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, the subdivision of a couple hundred rental houses and duplexes would have spanned nearly 30 acres east of Portage Road and south of Hupker Road. The property management company proposing the subdivision, Advenir Azora Development of Aventura, Florida, has not built housing in Madison before. City staff determined that proposed development conflicted with city plans to use most of the land the subdivision would have covered for stormwater and open space and not for housing.
Madison City Clerk Mary Beth Witzelbell has been put on administrative leave, Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway announced this morning. The move comes after several highly publicized election blunders in the city clerk's office this past fall. Those mistakes included the accidental mailing of duplicate absentee ballots and the failure to count another nearly 200 after November 5th. Some of the 193 ballots that went uncounted were discovered in time to amend the vote count, but Witzelbell and her staff failed to notify state and county authorities in time, waiting over a month to report the mistake. These mistakes have, quote, undermined, unquote, the mayor's confidence in the clerk's leadership, reports Isthmus newspaper. They've also led to two investigations and a class action lawsuit filed by voters. Witzelbell has served as the city clerk since 2006. Now on paid leave, her five-year contract is set to expire in September of 2026. Mayor Rhodes Conway also announced Witzelbell's interim replacement today, City Attorney Mike Haas, who previously served as the administrator and legal counsel at the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and before that, the Government Accountability Board. Haas told our producer, Faye Parks, this afternoon that he's prepared to pull double duty, especially in the busy weeks leading up to the April 1st election.
Fortunately, both the clerk's office and the city attorney's office have excellent professional staff that know what their responsibilities are and are used to carrying them out. And so to the extent that I'm spending more time in the clerk's office in this role, there will be attorneys in the city attorney's office. We have 18 total attorneys in that office, and so they will be stepping up to fill in any gaps if necessary.
Haas says the city clerk's office is committed to transparency, adding they're implementing two main changes to prevent a repeat of the November election. The first is more documentation.
to make sure that we're tracking the exact number of ballots that come into the clerk's office and as they leave the clerk's office and then arrive at the polling places and then come back to the clerk's office on election night, that there is some reconciliation at those checkpoints to make sure that there's no slippage in the numbers. And if there is, then we go hunting for ballots. That's the general idea. There's a few specific procedures and ways that we are documenting that the staff is implementing. One other significant change is we will be printing the poll books closer to the election, sometime in the week before the election rather than 2 weeks before the election. It takes quite a bit of time to print those poll books in Madison. When those poll books are printed, they indicate when absentee ballots have been returned. So we will be catching more of them, greater number of them, closer to the election than previously, which means that the staff will not need to hand mark additional absentee ballots that have come back after the poll books have been printed.
City Attorney Mike Haas there. In other election news, a Westsider is running for city council and may not be eligible to take office if he wins the race on April 1st. Former Alder Nino Amato is challenging incumbent Alder John Guerrieri, but he has yet to move to his new home in the district. Amato tells WORT he believed the residency requirements allowed him to move within 30 days after the election, alleging he was following advice from city staff. But Mike Haas says a candidate's residency has to be established in advance.
The state law requires that the candidate be a qualified elector, not only of the city, but of the district that they are running in. And to be a qualified elector at the time of election means you need to establish residency 28 days before the election. That's always been the rule. Well, it's been the rule, whether it's 10 or 28 days, the length of time has changed. But the point is that the residency has to be established in advance of the election, just like it is for voters.
Haas added today that the law is clear, though he's unfamiliar with Amato's case and his eligibility is still up in the air for now.
If there's a question about it, then we're going to have to dig into what are the facts, exactly where was he living when, and then to make a determination. There's a process after the election. After the votes are counted, the clerk's office issues a certificate of election to the winning candidates. And if the clerk finds that the candidate was not eligible to take office, then the clerk can decline to issue a certificate of candidacy.
The ballots for the April 1st election have already been printed and can't be changed, meaning that Amato remains a candidate despite the uncertainty. In-person early voting begins in 6 days. And those were tonight's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
An unsolved riddle for fusion energy companies: how to generate electricity in the most cost-effective way. But one Wisconsin firm is already selling a fusion byproduct to ripe markets as it works to generate the energy later. Shrine Technologies has received federal funding and just broke ground on a new facility in Fitchburg. Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection has more.
A Wisconsin firm has figured out a way to generate revenue before it cracks the code on generating electricity through fusion by selling neutrons. Shrine Technologies is selling a byproduct of the fusion reaction to industrial imaging and materials testing companies. The fusion reaction is essentially the energy source that powers the sun. Governments and investors are banking on engineers being able to replicate the idea to meet the planet's energy needs in centuries to come. In the meantime, Shrine Technologies CEO Greg Pfeiffer says he's pleased to have found a way to fund his company as it works on creating the energy.
You know, the fusion energy people are kind of trying to go from fusion not really having ever been used commercially for anything to it being the most reliable, cheapest form of generating energy.
Shrine just broke ground on a facility in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, which Pfeiffer says will be the largest of its kind in the world. He expects the company will generate about $50 million of revenue this year and says there are a couple more pit stops before ultimately making electricity. Fusion as an energy source has been researched for almost a century since its discovery. Most fusion companies have their own unproven methods for the process, but haven't been able to continuously generate more power than is used to create the fusion reaction in the first place. Pfeiffer admits Shrine doesn't have one yet either.
We're actually selling fusion. So we're not selling capacitors. We're not selling superconductors for other applications. We're actually selling fusion. That's an important differentiation.
Shrine Technologies has raised over $200 million since its founding in 2010 and has received tens of millions of dollars in federal funding. Overall, investors have put more than $7 billion into fusion companies so far. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from Eric Wessoff with Canary Media.
The time is now 6:20, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Kim Richmond is running to represent Madison's Far East Side on the city council. Now retired after 40 years in the soft drink and food industry, he's an active board member of the Elvium Neighborhood Association. Richmond faces one opponent this spring in Sean O'Brien. Current Alder J.L. Curry isn't seeking re-election this year. Sitting down with our news producer, Faye Parks, Kim Richmond touted his record of community service and his dedication to transparency.
Hi, I'm Kim Richmond. I have very deep East Side roots, and I'm very connected to the East Side. I was born and raised in Eastmoreland, which is only about 5 miles from where I live right now, in the Elvium neighborhood. My wife and I have been there for over 42 years. Some of the things I do currently, I am retired. A full-time work, I had a almost 40-year career in sales, marketing, advertising, and customer service in the soft drink and food industry. I am a City of Madison election official, and I always work in the 16th District unless I'm running. I'm on my Elvium Neighborhood Association Board of Directors as a director at large. I'm on the Community Police and Advisory Board in the East District Police Station, and what we do is we're kind of a bridge between the police department and people in the troubled neighborhoods in the 16th district. Probably right now the most critical one is the Meadowlands Apartments. I have already spent some time out there with the community youth officer as well as our neighborhood resource officer. I am all about transparency. I am all about accountability. I'm an East Side advocate, trying to connect with people, to communicate with them. I'd like to encourage stronger community engagement, which makes neighborhoods stronger.
Now, you previously ran for city council in 2021, but unofficially withdrew from the race. What inspired you to run again this year?
I haven't seen any changes in homelessness, in the lack of affordable housing, the lack of communication in the 16th district. I have knocked on tons of doors already in the past 7 weeks, and people are telling me people haven't gotten back to them. They haven't received answers, and that's what I do. I am guaranteeing people that I will get back to them. Currently, my campaign Gmail is empty because I answer every question I get or every discussion that I get that I can. That's how I will get back to the people. I just want to listen to them, bring them together, and we can all talk.
What is one specific achievement or policy that you would want to drive forward if elected in April?
Well, the number one thing I'm hearing and the number one thing for me as a resident is the budget, the way it's being handled, the lack of communication with the city government and the state legislature, the lack of lobbying to get our fair share. We are nowhere near what we should be getting for our fair share of state revenue. In the past, people have met with Robin Voss, and now it's turning political. This side is calling that side name, that side is calling this side name. Why don't the two entities get together? The city should show up with lobbyists, and they should talk to the state, tell them what we need, and have a discussion. This has been going on now for a few years since the city got rid of the lobbyists, especially a contracted firm, I believe. And the state is not going to give Madison money just for the heck of it. We've got to go there, not beg, but stand our ground and lobby the state for our fair share. And of course, currently, as of, I believe, February 6th, the city has come out with the news that they have hired a lobby firm for $72,000. And I applaud that, because that $72,000 investment should, and I say should, get us millions of dollars if these two people, or if these two entities, sit down and actually talk and fight for the city.
Yeah, I'd like to speak more on the city's budget issues. Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. Now, you mentioned lobbying the state legislature for more state aid, which would be no easy task. Assembly Speaker Voss said in a recent interview that the shared revenue formula is fine and that he wants to take away the ability for local governments to depend on referendums at all. Can you describe in more detail what efficiencies or changes to the city's budgeting process you would support moving forward?
Well, first of all, I think we should probably spend more than $72,000 to lobby the state. I don't agree with Voss. If we don't get our fair share of money from the state after making a conscious effort to lobby, we should be able to have a referendum to raise taxes. But that should be the last ditch effort. That's why we're hiring, that's why we're hiring these lobbyists to go do their job. I guess it's a conservative-based or conservative-by-history firm, so maybe that will even get us further in the door with a step. But I've also discussed with other people the last 6 or 8 months a possibility of a 0.5% city sales tax, which would kind of spread the income, not just for city residents, but for people visiting the city, for people visiting the university. So it would be not just residents paying extra, but it would be also include people coming into the city.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
We have to continue to build more apartments, houses, and duplexes. It's just supply and demand. Hopefully, once the supply goes up and the demand starts to come down, hopefully the rents and mortgages will go down. I'm an advocate for building smaller homes. Everybody doesn't want to rent an apartment on the fifth floor or the third floor. Some people still want homes. I believe in a home. So if we build smaller, more affordable homes, smaller lots, say 1,000 square feet, 1,200 square feet, everything small. I grew up in a house with 8x8 bedrooms or 10x10 and 3 bedrooms, and we were fine. So I think we need to do more of those for options, more duplexes on smaller lots as well. And also, I would be an advocate for helping out first-time homeowners and first-time generational homeowners. So if, let's, for example, my parents rented, my grandparents rented, I want to buy a house, I would be a first-time generation buyer. We should give those folks a small interest loan for 30, 40 years, whatever, and a smaller down payment. But of course, they'd have to make a commitment. But I am in total favor of that to help the housing crisis.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents in their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
Well, that's where discussion comes in. I mean, bottom line, you sit down and talk. You hold meetings. You hold discussions. If a lot of people can't make this day at this time, then have another one. That's what we're there to do. It's about public service. It's all about public service, and that's why I want. It's not about politics. It's about public service. You just work it out among everybody, because there is a common ground. Believe it or not, we all have a common ground in something. You might be left wing, you might be right wing, but there's always a common ground somewhere, and that's where we should start.
Kim Richmond will be on the April 1st ballot. He faces one opponent in Sean O'Brien, the policy and advocacy director at Fair Wisconsin. Current Alder J.L. Curry isn't running for another term. You can learn more about Kim Richman on his website, kimrichman.com.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories coming up for you in the second half of the show. We'll learn how UW-Madison leaders are preparing for federal cost-cutting measures. We'll travel back in time to 1967 and we'll broadcast the most in-depth weather report on the airwaves.
But first, another break, and we'll check back in with the BBC to see what's happening in the rest of the world. Stay tuned.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. U.S. officials are on their way to Russia to discuss a potential ceasefire in the conflict in Ukraine as the Trump administration tries to build on Tuesday's agreement with Kyiv. Donald Trump said agreement from Moscow would go 80% towards ending what he described as a bloodbath. In Russia, the Kremlin showed images of President Putin visiting the Kursk region, where his forces have been retaking territory seized by Ukraine last year. The Pakistani military says it's freed more than 300 hostages from a train at the end of a siege by separatist militants in Balochistan. An army spokesman said 33 rebels were killed. The former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has been taken into custody at the International Criminal Court. He's being detained on charges of murder as a crime against humanity over his deadly war on drugs. Some of America's largest trading partners have announced retaliatory measures after the Trump administration introduced blanket tariffs on steel and aluminium imports. They include Canada and the EU. The new US government is scrapping wide-ranging environmental protections introduced under President Biden. They include restrictions on carbon emissions from coal plants and vehicles. A march by Argentine pensioners has ended in violence and the arrest of 30 people after football supporters joined the rally. They were inspired by their hero, the late Diego Maradona, who once said you'd have to be a real coward not to defend retirees. Scientists say fossilized fragments of bone found in a cave in Spain are the cheek and jaw of the most ancient face discovered in Western Europe. They're thought to belong to a now extinct human species, Homo erectus. And in the past few minutes, the launch of a spacecraft expected to bring back two US astronauts who've been stranded on the International Space Station for more than 9 months has been cancelled. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus. The federal funding chaos has UW-Madison leadership rethinking research priorities and preparing for a potential loss of $65 million a year. Sitting down with host Oliver Gerhars, campus news editor Gavin Escott shared some takeaways from last week's Faculty Senate meeting.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
In early March, UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin held a faculty senate meeting where she told UW-Madison faculty how the university was expecting to respond to potential funding cuts. Today we're joined by the Daily Cardinal's campus news editor Gavin Escott to talk about Mnookin's address in a discussion of his story, There Aren't Easy Answers, Mnookin Fields Faculty Questions on NIH Funding Cuts, Impact on Junior Faculty and Graduate Students. Could you tell us a little bit about the graduate student experience at UW-Madison?
UW-Madison is a top research institution. It's an R1, which means it heavily focuses on research, and for decades it's produced some of the nation's top scientific breakthroughs. Now, this could all be affected in the case of a potential NIH budget cut.
Tell me about the budget cap on the National Institutes of Health and what that's been looking like recently.
The National Institutes of Health are proposing a 15% cap on indirect costs across the board. And indirect costs, a lot of people think it's just overhead, but it's, as some researchers have put it, an absolutely critical part of the scientific enterprise. They support facilities through lab purchases. They fund construction. They fund maintenance. Without indirect costs, the university wouldn't be able to do the research that they want to do. And the indirect costs aren't something that the university can pay out of its own pocket. Let's say a researcher receives an $100,000 grant from the National Institutes of Health. UW-Madison has an indirect cost cap of 27 to 55.5%. That would mean that UW-Madison would receive $55,000 in addition to the $100,000. So the federal government would give UW-Madison $55,000 to pay for those costs that the university doesn't have the money to do. And at the faculty senate meeting, Mnookin underlined something that a lot of researchers have been saying for weeks. If this 15% cap goes through, the university will have to rethink the way it goes through the grant process because the university won't be able to pay these costs themselves. They won't be able to pay those $50,000 construction and maintenance fees. So they'll have to decline a lot of grants, which is going to have a cascading effect on research and funding opportunities for graduate students.
Mnookin recently released some guidelines. What do those look like?
Mnookin and the university leadership have told deans to recommend decreasing the amount of incoming graduate students. So students that have already been accepted, they haven't said that they're going to be turned away, but they're trying to encourage them to decline their own admissions. And that's to preserve a couple things. One, the university wants to maintain a yield similar to other schools. This problem with indirect costs is a problem that all research institutions share. So other schools are going to see graduate admissions go down because they're going to experience budget cuts. And UW-Madison doesn't want to have 5,000 graduate students here while other institutions only have 2,000 because the yield disparity is going to hurt the university. So the university wants to, one, match the other institutions, and two, predict what level of funding they'll be able to have for future graduate students. They don't want to accept more students than they'll have the funding capacity for. So caution's the word of the day. They're also recommending labs not buy additional materials, kind of pause what they say are unnecessary purchases as well.
So when they say unnecessary purchases, what does that mean?
It's really up to the discretion of the labs. They've told labs to halt unnecessary purchases, and that's also had an effect on graduate students who want to enter other labs. A story I'm working on right now concerns graduate students who want to enter a different lab and are being turned away because lab predict they won't have the funding for them in 5 years. So even though these budget caps aren't being implemented at the moment, there is a sort of chilling effect where labs are predicting, hey, we're not going to have this money, so we're going to have to turn you away. It seems like this is going to be the situation until we get more clarity on what will be the case going forward.
Yeah, I mean, all this ambiguity, it's got to really be having consequences because you have to make decisions. This is a time of year where you have to make decisions about who you're going to admit. And the people you admit, they're not being admitted into anything small. I mean, a lot of these grad programs are, like you said, 5 years.
Yeah.
Like the way things are going down the road is really going to be interesting.
Something the university highlighted was that it's going to maintain its commitment to multi-year programs. So, like you said, a lot of grad students are admitted into programs that last multiple years just because they don't think they'll have the funding for programs down the line. The university has said that they're going to keep these students as they are. The university has said they have a commitment to their current students, current undergrad and graduate students, but incoming graduate students may not have those same opportunities. So while multi-year graduate students right now will have at least some assurance of the future going forward, that's not something that we can expect for the future if these cuts go through.
One question I have to ask about this is, so looking past UW-Madison, how might these funding cuts affect the entire state of Wisconsin?
UW-Madison is Wisconsin's biggest employer, and NIH funding directly contributes billions of dollars every year into the Wisconsin economy. So university leaders have said that if UW-Madison loses this funding, it's going to have a ripple effect on the Wisconsin economy. These lab purchases, these facility maintenance costs, those are all things that go towards Wisconsin taxpayers. You buy materials from Wisconsin businesses. You employ Wisconsin people to clean these labs. When that's no longer the case, that's definitely going to affect the Wisconsin economy. And in addition to that, because of the decreased opportunities for research, there's going to be less groundbreaking research that comes out of the state, which is going to have an effect on the state economy as well.
And is there anything else that you learned over the course of your reporting that stuck out to you?
What I talked about before, about not just the direct costs that these are causing, the ambiguity, but the chilling effect as well. People are acting like these cuts will go through. Labs aren't admitting graduate students because they expect that they won't have the funding for it. The university is beginning to rethink grants. Long-term projects that were started years ago are being halted. This is already having an effect, even if it hasn't gone through. And while it varies from lab to lab, some labs say that there's a culture of fear in their environment because they don't know what happens next. Everything is day-to-day, and it all seems to happen on the federal government's whim.
Wow. That's just another reminder that everything really is up in the air right now. Well, thanks for being here on the news, Gavin.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
In campus news, Brent Pleisch has been named chief of UW-Madison's police department. Pleisch, who joined UWPD in 2005, will assume the position on the 16th of March. Pleisch has been the interim police chief since February 11th, 2024, when former police chief Kristen Roman resigned amid an internal investigation documenting multiple university policy violations. Pleisch said that UWPD will continue to focus on building relationships and learning about community expectations. In campus sports news, Wisconsin men's basketball loses a game to Penn State. The Penn State Nittany Lions defeated the Badgers 86-75 this Saturday, making for Penn State's first win in Madison this century and a loss at the end of the regular season for Wisconsin. Head coach Greg Gard said after the loss, quote, "This one stings for our seniors and for our fans and everybody. Not the performance that we wanted or desired. We are better than this." Unquote. That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hinkstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, we've seen the thermometer bobbing up and down a good bit over the past few days, as you would expect, I suppose, as we transition from winter to spring in Wisconsin. The vernal equinox is coming up later next week. Yesterday's 48-degree high temperature was nearly a 20-degree drop after Monday's 67. We popped back up to 54 today, and we'll jump into the 60s tomorrow. Quite likely the 70s on Friday before crashing again then back to the 50s on Saturday, perhaps just the 30s on Sunday. So a very active pattern will continue with a good bit of north-south mixing of air masses up and down the continent. Monday's 67, by the way, was a record high temperature, eclipsing the 66 that was set back in 1894. We had a lot of passing high clouds that day, and I thought that was going to scupper our chances, but we did manage to squeak through nonetheless. Have a look at the water vapor satellite image of North America that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll see the upper pattern responsible for our ups and downs these past few days, with the polar jet stream snaking from west to east roughly across about the 45th parallel, but with plenty of north-south meanders in it, so ridges and troughs moving at a fairly brisk pace across the continent. The large upper ridge across the center of the country at the beginning of the sequence is what delivered us our record warmth on Monday. And as you can see, as the image sequence plays forward, we've got an equally amplified ridge now developing upstream of us again over the west coast and intermountain region. That's Friday's warmth, basically, shaping up with the south to north feed of air building that upper ridge, being rotated into place by the deep leftward spinning upper trough that's just behind it off the California coast. The energy in the pit of that trough is going to spin up a fairly potent surface low pressure circulation on the plains of Colorado tomorrow night or early Friday, which will crank southerly winds northward into Wisconsin from the Gulf of Mexico during the day Friday. How much moisture gets delivered by those winds will be a factor in determining just how strong the thunderstorms will be that we see later in the day when an occluding frontal boundary ramps northeastward into Wisconsin from Iowa. It appears now that much or all of the day Friday will be dry, with upward forcing for thunderstorms holding off perhaps until after dark. An average of the forecast models show the dew points struggling to reach the low 50s, so there won't be enormous amounts of available potential energy for upward motion, but strong speed shear combined with some directional veering as well through the lower part of the air column, will make for a conducive environment for fast-moving and well-organized storms, capable of producing strong straight-line winds, especially in areas in which bows might form along any northeastward advancing line segments on Friday. While the low-level environment may possibly be conducive to supercell development as well, especially far to our south in Illinois where there's a bit more energy, much more likely is something up here like a more mixed mode of convection with line segments or perhaps groups of cells moving rapidly northeastward or possibly forming into a single advancing line out ahead of the frontal boundary. So strong winds and possibly also some hail would be the likeliest severe threats with the storms on Friday. Passing showers then behind the main convective line are likely to continue into the day Saturday as a Pacific origin air mass continues to get swept around the main storm circulation, which is going to be passing to our northwest through Minnesota. And we may eventually see some light snow actually out of this system as a secondary cold front with more Arctic origin air then sweeps in later Saturday and Saturday night. That might restrain the temperatures sub 40 on Sunday. And in fact, that's looking like a pretty good bet. We will warm again in the subsequent week, though, with a fairly active upper air pattern continuing through much of the coming 16 days, the way it's looking to glance at the longer-range forecast models. But back to tonight, the skies will continue to see only passing strands of cirrus, with temperatures dropping to the low to mid-30s by dawn on light easterly winds, generally coming down below 5 miles per hour. Actually, the winds are already down below 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, passing high and mid-level clouds may block the sun a bit, but temperatures should nevertheless crack 60 on increasing southeasterly winds, which will come up to 5 to 10 miles per hour by the end of the day. Additional lower clouds may develop then as we go through the overnight period and south to southeasterly winds remain active. Temperatures may initially drop towards about the low 40s overnight, but then start to rise towards dawn on Friday. And southeasterly winds will intensify through the morning hours Friday as and it's possible that returning moisture aloft may saturate enough to throw down maybe a brief sprinkle in the early morning hours or perhaps just produce some fall streaks from the clouds. Temperatures will climb steadily Friday through the 50s and 60s with dew points reaching the low 50s, so palpably more moist. Cloud cover is a bit of an uncertainty that day. With decent clearing later in the day, we're likely to achieve 70 degrees, perhaps better than that, though upper 60s may result from clouds persisting on through sundown. South to southeast winds will increase to 12 to 20 miles per hour with some gustiness as well. Showers and thunderstorms then become much more likely by sundown or shortly after, with the period between about 8 p.m. and midnight looking like the likeliest period for onset from the consensus of the models. Those should move in rapidly from the south and west, perhaps, as I mentioned, with strong winds and hail, but should move through in just a couple of hours once they get going. Veering winds more south and southwesterly. Temperatures will drop to the mid-50s overnight. More scattered showers may then pass from time to time as we go into and through the morning hours of Saturday, with temperatures holding in the mid-50s for much of that day, then dropping later on as southwesterly winds at 12 to 20 miles per hour veer more westerly. Passing showers then may turn over to some light snow as we go overnight, and incoming colder air drops the temperatures down past freezing, down to the upper 20s by dawn on Sunday. And Sunday will be cold by comparison and windy as well, with temperatures recovering just to the upper 30s. The temperature is 49 degrees currently down here at the station on Bedford Street. The dew point temperature is 29. Winds have been variable and generally below 5 miles per hour the past several minutes, and passing cirrus overhead in an otherwise fairly clear sky above the station. The barometer's at 29.81 inches of mercury and fairly steady over the past few hours.
It is now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to March 1967 for news of anti-war protest, exciting cultural news, and a transit tragedy. Stu Levitan has the headlines from 58 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, March 1967. The month opens with a tragedy long predicted. When the expanded University Avenue opened in November 1966 with four lanes heading west and a bus lane heading east, campus leaders warned of a likely tragedy. It finally happens on March 1st, as campus beauty queen Donna Shuler walks into the side of a bus and is injured so badly that her left leg has to be amputated. Students, faculty, administration, and regents renew their plea with the city to move the bus to West Johnson Street, but it doesn't. On the 2nd, the Wisconsin Student Association Senate votes 19-11 to ban the Madison chapter of Students for a Democratic Society from campus until at least next fall, as punishment for the role its leaders played in the disruptive protest against the Dow Chemical Company in late February. WSA Senator Paul Soglin, who joined the peaceful mass occupation of a Bascom Hall hallway in a related protest, argues against the suspension. The ban, which SDS President Hank Haslett calls childish and the student court quickly overturns, greatly enhances SDS's popularity and expands its membership to about 300 overnight. On the 6th, Chancellor Robin Fleming issues a more meaningful statement, detailing that he will continue to use all force necessary to ensure compliance with the administrative rule against disruptive protests. Fleming gives the document an oratorical flair, quote, "Given the traditions of this campus, it is fair to assume that the faculty wants to preserve dissent but without anarchy, and that it wants order but without oppression." At a special meeting 2 days later, the faculty rejects by 4-1 a motion by sociology professor Maurice Zeitlin to ban job interviews by corporations, quote, "involved in producing war materials," and adopts instead a policy allowing all bona fide employers to recruit on campus. According to the results of a WSA referendum on March 21st, students want there to be a draft, which they think they should be exposed to. 9,000 students vote by roughly equal 1,000-vote margins not to abolish the draft and that the university should stop compiling class rankings, which young men need to maintain their 2S student deferments. On campus, March is a great month for music, theater, and the underground press. March 3rd to 7th, the radical literary journal Quixote and Madison SDS present the anti-LBJ adaptation of Macbeth, McBird, in Ag Hall. It's just days after the world premiere in Greenwich Village, and playwright Barbara Garson makes a special appearance. On March 7th, the first underground newspaper in the state, Connections, is published as Bob Gabriner and Stuart Ewan expand their 1965 counterculture commentary Act Tracks into 16 edgy and irreverent pages. It's experimental at all levels, from layout to distribution, and, quote, "dedicated to remaining underground rather than being buried above ground." The paper is delayed a day when North Shore Publishers in Milwaukee refuses to print it. The Courier Hub Publishing Company takes the job, but insists on blanking out certain words. The editors agree that an expurgated paper is better than having no paper at all. On the 11th, rhythm blues great Smokey Robinson and All the Miracles bring Motown to the Stock Pavilion for Greek Week. On the 17th, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band plays two blistering Union Theater sets, earning cheers from the crowd and a condescending review in the Capital Times. Assembly Speaker Harold Frelich has an even lower opinion of youth culture. On the 22nd, he calls on the powerful Joint Finance Committee to cut the university's budget as punishment for, quote, "the moral and social degeneration on the campus." Frelich is especially incensed at the Daily Cardinal's publication of a photo taken inside a bathroom. The biggest entertainment news happens on a rainy Easter afternoon in the town of Madison, as a crowd of about 4,000 attends the dedication of the Dane County Memorial Coliseum. The March 26th celebration comes barely 4.5 years after Dane County decided to build a sports and entertainment arena. The building is 312 feet around, 98 feet high at its center, with 7,670 permanent seats and up to 3,330 temporary ones. It was designed by the firm Law Law Potter & Nystrom, whose founding partner, James R. Law, was mayor when the city first considered Frank Lloyd Wright's auditorium and convention center overlooking Lake Monona in the park now named for Mayor Law. Some finishing touches remain, but Coliseum manager Roy Gumtow vows everything will be ready for the inaugural event next weekend, the Zohr Shrine Circus. The teen set has to wait a few weeks for the first pop act, Paul Revere and the Raiders. In schoolhouse news, when UW graduate student Mark Greenside refused to shave his tidy goatee, Robert M. La Follette High School principal August Vandermeulen fired him from serving as an unpaid student teacher. On the 16th, Superintendent Robert Gilbert says Vandermeulen acted properly because the trim facial hair, quote, would not have a desirable effect on students. Greenside, who must perform student teaching to obtain his license, accepts an offer from the Verona schools. In the middle of the month, the West Side gangs strike again as teen vandals with slingshots and rocks break 21 windows and several reinforced doors at Charles Van Hise Elementary School, causing about $2,000 in damages. It's the seventh such instance at Van Hise, Odana, and Orchard Ridge schools since September, accounting for nearly $10,000 in damages. Police later nab five youngsters who explain they did it, quote, for lack of anything better to do. And on the 24th, following long-standing practice, most Madison stores, all banks, and all government offices except the post office are closed from noon to 3 p.m. for Good Friday. But something new this year during services, anti-war demonstrations inside the First Methodist, Covenant Presbyterian, and Bashford Methodist churches. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6, and thanks especially to all of you who were able to support us during our recent pledge drive and be keeping our news independent of commercial influence in this slot. Our headline writers this evening were Nate Carlin, Greg Sanderson, and a big welcome back to Jack Goodman, who's a longtime Wednesday evening news writer from way back in the day when we were in our backyard. Great to have you back on site, Jack.
Welcome back, Jack.
Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhardt, Ted Hingstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella is our on-air engineer. Faye Perks produced the newscast, and Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Thank you again for all of your support. Have a great night.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent fall pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Epic Mortgage Lending, Festival Foods, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zan, Mickey's Tavern, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Avenue, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle Fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth, and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle Fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle Fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle Fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
Hi friends, Vicki Kenyon here, occasional host of Query on WORT Madison 89.9 FM. Hey, I wanted to take a minute to say thank you so much, listeners, for your amazing support of our Winter Pledge Drive the last 2 weeks. The on-air drive officially ended Sunday night. If you didn't have a chance to donate or you'd like to just throw some more money in the pot, you can still do that online at WORTFM.org. Click the orange button with the heart on it, or on the app, you can find the donate button there as well.